You're listening to Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. I'm Steve Chiotakis. Let's take a hike up Flat Top, a hill next to the 110 freeway in Lincoln Heights, northeast of downtown LA. More than 36 undeveloped acres. Get to the top, and you have a sweeping view of the city. But the view won't be here for the taking if developers build apartments on this spot. And that's been a point of contention for working class Lincoln Heights. Development.
I'm a resident of Lincoln Heights, and I strongly oppose this project, which will gut a historical community and disenfranchise and endanger its residents. This is nothing more than a violent act of gentrification, racism, and oppression, pandemics that have long persisted before COVID-19.
That's Amanda Ross Ho speaking at a public hearing opposing a proposed apartment complex. She's not alone in the neighborhood, but complaining to city officials hasn't stopped the building. It's a familiar story. In a city desperate for more housing, undeveloped pieces of land all over Southern California have apartments planned for them, and many of them have neighbors who don't like those plans. But some Lincoln Heights residents decided to do something a little more radical about it. No, they're not trying to tear down the city system. Instead, if you can't beat the system, join it. Here's KCRW's Angel Carreras.
Last year, Sarah Clendenning was busy with a social media news service for Lincoln Heights called Lincoln Heights Intel. They do mutual aid work, clean Flat Top, inform the community of goings-on, that kind of stuff. When she heard about a development called Avenue 34, a mixed-use project development with 468 apartments, her first concern was that other communities were learning more about it than the people in her own neighborhood.
We realized that the developer had only done outreach with a small number of community members that were of the bordering communities of Montecito Heights, like richer people, whiter people. And I was like, we need to bring the 39,000 other people of Lincoln Heights to the table here because this is the biggest development in the history of the community and nobody talked to anybody.
Once Sarah and her neighbors learned more about the project, they raised more concerns. Neighbors worried the site next door, if excavated, could release toxic fumes. They also felt it didn't have enough affordable housing. 3/4 of the residents here being renters. Would market rate housing gentrify the neighborhood, push current residents out?
They have like incentives, like they can make so many units affordable, but to get an affordable unit you have to make like $70,000. It's like the threshold's so high, so like Lincoln Heights can only afford extremely low income housing, that meaning like you make under $20,000 and that housing isn't being built.
The developer, the Pinion Group, didn't respond to KCRW's request for an interview. Their plan calls for 60% of the units to be reserved for middle income households and 14% for low income, with the rest market rate. Pinion Group also said they follow strict state toxic control standards. There was also concern the developer had paid people outside the neighborhood to speak in favor of the project. The Pinion Group said they let go of a consultant who offered money to a public speaker. And not everyone in the neighborhood dislikes the project. At a city planning hearing, a resident named Minerva had this to say about the area now, with no apartment complex.
It's always been an eyesore. I could not be more in support of this project because I think it's starting to beautify the area. I don't fully understand about displacing the people when there's nothing there but ugly, abandoned buildings.
But Lincoln Heights Intel, they weren't having it.
We started a petition. It went viral. And it got 3,700 signatures and 3,700 statements, actual statements against the project. And it's massive. It's like over 100 pages of just people pleading for their lives. The high school teachers, the kids, like insane.
Here's that former Lincoln High teacher leaving comment in an LA City Planning Commission meeting late last year.
Hi, my name is Sergio Vera. You know, I've seen a lot of my students they've been displaced. It's very sad. You know, I'm almost coming to tears because it really makes me sad, but proud that all these people are here fighting for their community. And it just makes me very proud. And I'm literally in tears right now. And I hope this doesn't pass. Thank you.
Lincoln Heights Intel couldn't lean on their council member, Gil Cedillo. He declined an interview request from KCRW, but a spokesperson wrote that Cedillo approves the project after negotiating some changes, that is, more affordability, keeping tabs on potential soil toxicity, and relieving potential traffic congestion. So for Lincoln Heights Intel, that left who else to turn to, their neighborhood council?
Our current neighborhood council didn't really make quorum all year. They weren't showing up to any meetings. A lot of those neighborhood council members have been on the board since, like, 2008, just kind of taking up space.
The neighborhood council is basically just advisory to their LA City Council member, but...
You know, advisory can become influential.
That's Rafe Sonnenschein, executive director of the Pat Brown Institute for Public Affairs at Cal State LA. He created the concept of neighborhood councils in the year 2000 to give people at the neighborhood level a greater voice at City Hall.
I think a lot of the neighborhood councils have developed quite a bit of influence. In fact, developers, council members, others, those who don't like developers, those who don't like the council members, now would like to have the support of the neighborhood council. So even without the formal power to make decisions, they've evolved into something that at least is worth fighting over.
That's how Sarah Clendenning and Lincolnites Intel saw it. From their perspective, the Lincolnites Neighborhood Council was not spending enough time fighting development. And so, Lincolnites Intel put together a slate of progressive candidates for the Neighborhood Council. 11 people to oust every current Neighborhood Council member at hand, with a platform focusing on equitable land use. And it just so happened that...
Lincolnites Neighborhood Council was ripe for the picking from a group to come in.
That's Gilbert Aravalo, a former president of the Lincoln Heights Neighborhood Council.
The previous president resigned because there was too much arguing and everything going on in the meetings and took some members with him. We had a low membership and was barely able to have a quorum so that we had a meeting. So we had difficulties having meetings for reaching quorum.
Lincoln Heights Intel capitalized on the dysfunction. They started registering potential voters, and on April 13th, the neighborhood voted by mail. But they worried when the city clerk ruled at Lincoln Heights, Intel isn't a community organization, and that voters that signed up to vote through them shouldn't count. That cost them over 200 voters. That's painful for a neighborhood council election, already a system with small voter turnouts. So a couple weeks go by, and April 27th, the results. Lincoln Heights Intel, they won. Everyone in their slate, all 11 candidates, Sarah Clendenning is the new president.
The official election results came out, and we were like over the top. Of local votes, on average, we got like each candidate got like 120 votes, and then their competitors got like 12 votes. We kicked their asses.
So does that mean Lincoln Heights won't be gentrified? Well, here's Sonnenschein again, and then Sarah.
Neighborhood councils are players, even though they can't make a development happen or they can't stop one, but they can make it more likely to happen or less likely to happen by their support or opposition. And that's why, even without formal power over land use, they are potentially going to become players in some of the land use politics in the city. And therefore, people think they're worth fighting over.
So now we've won, and we're going to keep getting people hip to the city planning and land use stuff. And then we're going to get more seats, and then we're going to rise up into City Hall and then take those seats, and then we're going to gain a position of power, and we're going to change the land use policies so they're more equitable. So we're going to become councilman, and we're going to become mayor, and we're going to like take it up to the top.
The new neighborhood council doesn't mean the Avenue 34 project is dead. It's been approved. But it and future development certainly won't have an easy path to construction. For KCRW, I'm Angel Carreras.
Lincoln Heights, Boyle Heights, Angelino Heights, wherever you are, whatever heights you're in, or city, municipality, in greater LA, know that you are an important part of our mission to inform and to help drive the conversation, to educate, and yes, even make a difference in the community, to reach new heights. With that in mind, I'd like to remind you that KCRW's Drive to the Future is our spring fundraiser that not only benefits the radio station, but also community organizations all around greater LA. We're focusing on public health and education and housing, three issues that have come into focus over the years, but certainly since the beginning of the pandemic over the last year plus. We're giving a portion of our proceeds and attention to those causes this week, or today at least. Today's the last day that we're focusing on homelessness. Support KCRW today, and part of your contribution will help provide legal aid for people experiencing homelessness. Plus, we have this challenge grant, $20,000 from anonymous KCRW champions for today only. If we can raise 20 grand with your support, they'll double it. KCRW.com/give. Together, we can build a better future, and thank you for your support of KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
All right, onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiatakis. One of the biggest challenges in combating the coronavirus is breaking through the politics of it. Sadly, this virus that's upended so many lives has also put people in different corners. Medical science versus conspiracy hoax, vaccine versus no vaccine, mask versus no mask. Social media is full of those clashes. Blaine Pope was picking up his 11-year-old daughter from school in Santa Monica. They had the option to walk the one block to their car and pass by 10 or so anti-mask protesters, ignoring what they had to say. Or, as Blaine's daughter urged them to do, not ignore, certainly not clash, but ask questions, talk, and hear from folks about why they believe what they believe. You know, engage in a civic-minded way. And Blaine Pope is here to tell us more about that afternoon. Hey there, Blaine.
Hello.
I think we should start by saying that this isn't a debate. This is about the discourse that happened. And I'd like you to tell us more about what happened after that school pickup with your daughter when you were walking back to the car.
Yeah, well, it started out like any other school afternoon, I guess, post-COVID now. I was fully just prepared to pick up my daughter, take her back home, make her lunch or after-school snack, what have you. But she turned to me and asked if we could go and get a closer look at who it was that was actually protesting just down the street from her school. And I sort of looked down the block and tried to calculate the situation. I thought, well, the people don't look menacing, really. And I said, sure, let's go down and let's see. And, you know, you can ask questions and let's see if we can find someone to talk to. And by we did. And I'll say that, you know, for the first minute or so, easily, it was just her asking her questions and me listening, but trying to, you know, be there as a sort of backstop or safety net, if you will. But gradually I found myself beginning to sort of chime in into the discussion as well. But the whole idea was to try and keep it as civil as possible, because while we were standing there with my daughter asking her questions and then me later joining in, there's this sort of slow parade of cars that are going by of parents who've just picked up their children from the gate at school. And there's all sorts of, how do I say, abuses that are being hurled out of some of these cars at the people
at the protesters.
With the signs. The correct, yes. And while I could, you know, I can sort of understand some of the frustration of many of those parents, I'm looking at those cars going by, the parade of abuse, I'll call it, and looking at the people with the signs, looking at myself and my daughter in this situation and thinking, it doesn't necessarily have to be this way. I mean, we can still find a way to have some kind of civil discussion, even on things, or I'll say especially important, to have it on things, on topics that are challenging or difficult or get our blood pressure up. So the whole idea was to kind of model for my daughter, in part, how do we have this kind of discussion and not want to scratch each other's eyes out in the process? That how do we talk about something that's difficult to talk about, but do so in a respectful way? So that was really it in a nutshell in terms of the tone.
I think of younger people as being a little more idealized, you know, that they see the world maybe through a different lens. And I don't think they don't have the years of cynicism, right? They don't have years of living on this planet to gather that cynicism, right? So you see a young person as like, well, maybe I can break through some of this, or I'd like to know more about why you're saying the things you're saying. Is that how this all began?
I think that's a good way to put it. My daughter, you know, my wife and I both try to inculcate in her a sense of intellectual curiosity to, you know, as safely as is reasonably possible these days, to explore the world and ask legitimate questions. And so I felt like my job in part being together with her there was to sort of contribute to the tone of things, the tone and the tenor of the discussion, And naturally, I sort of jumped in, of course, with content as well, but really to just kind of model the tone that, that could be had. And Steve, I have to say, I in no way planned this, and I certainly didn't plan the reaction that this has gotten in the media. It's caught us all a little bit by surprise, but in a good way. I'm glad that people are at least discussing this now.
As far as civil discourse goes, I mean, you've got to learn something from it, right? I mean, what did you take away from that civil discourse? Did you learn something new from people who say you shouldn't have to wear masks? Did they convince you otherwise? What did you leave there feeling?
Yeah, you know, you and other people have asked me similar questions about, you know, what was the takeaway, or did anyone change each other's mind in this process? My mind was certainly not changed. My daughter's mind was certainly not changed. And I'm going to venture to say that among the two individuals in particular who we're having focused discussion with, I doubt in the short run their minds were changed. And I was not seeking to change minds so much as I was seeking to talk with people. You know, sometimes we just talk about the weather with people we don't know at the bus stop. Sometimes we talk about the last sports game, et cetera, just for casual discussion. And that was really the tone I was trying to keep it at that time. If there's going to be any change of heart and mind, Steve, that may not be for another year or 2 years or 5 years. As someone thinks back about that conversation they had with that man and his daughter that day, that maybe somewhere as the weight of evidence begins to bear down on them, they'll think maybe he had a point. And to add to that, I'll have to say, I have to be open to the idea that maybe I'll see something in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years that will cause me to think, maybe what some of those guys were saying was correct. Maybe there's some issue. I have to at least be open to that, even if I'm not in that place at this time. So I guess I'm approaching it with a slightly different view or bringing a slightly different energy to the conversation.
But this is about the discourse in and of itself and the fact that it didn't have to be shouting. It didn't have to be talking at one another. This was having a dialogue with people, finding out their point of view and why they came to their conclusion, their respective conclusions, and why you came to yours. And you left there saying, you know what, we agree to disagree, but here we are as people on the streets of Santa Monica.
Exactly. And I'll say I sort of brought the same energy or skill set or tone that I do when I teach. And my approach is not really to either applaud something I agree with or jump down the throat of a student who maybe I disagree with, but really to just explore their thought process and allow people to express themselves. And then we begin to flesh out these concepts one by one. That's essentially the tone I was taking with these individuals, even though it's not in a classroom setting, strictly speaking, but in a way it was, again, for my daughter. But still a similar approach. We can still have good adult conversations. We don't necessarily have to convince each other in that moment that one side's right, one side's wrong, but maybe we sit with that for a while and we sit with these difficult issues and let these issues percolate. That's another approach, simply.
Well, Blaine Pope, I want to thank you for your time, professor of business administration at CSUN, and of course your biggest job, dad. And I appreciate you talking to us about that encounter, and let's hope for more, at least some civil discourse going forward.
I think that's the most important thing. But yes, thank you. It was a pleasure to talk with you, Steve.
All right, moving along now with this episode of Greater LA on KCRW. To green or not to green? That is the question in Garden Grove. Let's head on over to Orange County. Climate change and rising temperatures have Garden Grove City Council debating tomorrow a long-term plan for funding, maintaining, and planting more trees in that city over the next 4 decades. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist at the LA Times, a contributor, of course, here at Greater LA. He's also the host of a brand new daily another podcast called The Times. Hey, Gustavo.
Hola, Steve.
I guess there's room for two podcasts, two daily podcasts.
And I'm on the two best ones in Southern California, right? Greater LA and the Times.
That's very nice of you, Gustavo. All right. Orange County is called Orange County for a reason. Obviously, it was home to a lot of orange groves. What is the situation in Garden Grove now when it comes to trees, and how does it compare to other parts of the OC?
Yeah, you know, when I came across this story, I had to think, like, how many trees are there in Garden Grove? In other words, how many, you know, because Garden Grove, it's in the name, Garden Grove. This used to be like the strawberry capital of Southern California, orange groves or whatever. And when I think about it, most of it is just a lot of strip malls, you know, individual houses. Yes, they'll have some trees, but nowhere near compared to, like, say, the city of Anaheim, which has a lot of parks, even in Santana, which has, you know, big old trees. It's kind of barren. So, like, you never really walk in Garden Grove. You have to drive around just because everything's so spread out. So I'm like, oh, yeah, there's not that many trees there.
You have the Crystal Cathedral there, too, right?
Well, now it's Christ Cathedral, remember, after the Schulers declared bankruptcy.
That's right. The diocese bought it. Now, how did a town with a name, though, I mean, so it became devoid of all these trees because of all those developments, because of the strip malls and the housing projects, things like that?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it used to be a wonderland in Orange County. I mean, kind of, because, of course, you had exploited Mexicans picking all those oranges from the trees. But the older residents will tell you about how there used to be so many orange groves that at certain times during the summer, if you got a breeze, you'd get the smell of orange blossoms covering all of Orange County. But what happened after World War II, suburbanization, these farmers said, we don't want to deal with trees anymore. We'd just rather sell it off to developers. And Garden Grove during the 1950s, at one point, it was the fastest growing city in the United States. I mean, there's very few old parts of Garden Grove. Frankly, most of it was really built after the 1950s. So you had this agricultural wonderland just dug up for cheap tract homes.
We know that trees, Gustavo, help provide shade. That's a big thing, right? For some of the city's most vulnerable residents, children, outdoor workers, the unhoused, of course. How else do they help a community in this time of climate change? Do they really cool things down?
Oh, as someone who has a big peach tree and a growing lemon tree in their front yard, I could tell you how much things cool down, especially as you start getting hotter and hotter days. I also grew up in Anaheim, and in front of our house, we had, oh, geez, the tree right in our front yard, but then we had a humongous jacaranda tree in our front yard as well, which I hated because the stupid flowers just gum up everything. But
it's that time of year, by the way.
I know. That's why I'm like, no, I don't want this anymore. Thank God I don't live there. Yeah. But the shade, yeah, it cools down so much. And more importantly, it's nature. It's beautiful. I think it's part of our, you know, our privilege here in Southern California to have a climate, at least historically, where you could grow almost anything. So you would see all these fruit trees. And with climate change, that helps you at least get, you know, compare that to trying to go someplace where there are not many trees, like, say, even, you know, East L.A., certain parts. It gets hot and really fast.
Yeah, the heat island, as it were, you know, all that asphalt and concrete. There is in Garden Grove this plan that the city council will decide whether or not to adopt tomorrow. What is in this urban forest management plan?
So in this idea, this plan is the idea that maybe Garden Grove should start growing more trees. And it's not much. I mean, it takes a while, obviously, for trees to grow. But as it stands for the last 5 years, the Garden Grove budget has spent less than 1% on tree management, tree maintenance. It's starting to pick up in a couple of years. But the idea is, again, that, you know, this is a city that could stand to have more trees. It cools everything down and makes things prettier. And also it adds property value to the houses around wherever these trees may be. And this is a city project, mind the way. This is not yet going into the private sector to tell people, like, hey, here, have an avocado tree. Start growing them.
You remember when here in L.A., Mayor Villaraigosa, he famously had that plan to plant 1 million trees in L.A. I remember that. He made it almost halfway. I mean, it takes some time and it takes some money to get all those trees in the ground, right?
Oh, yeah. Not only not just money, but really the time, because, you know, trees, like, maybe they'll grow like 2 to 3 feet, you know, within 5-6 years, then you start wondering, hey, where's our investment? But this is not an investment in the now. It's our investment in the future. Imagine the people who planned modern-day Southern California when they planted those humongous oaks and all these other, you know, sycamores and eucalyptus and all these other trees 50, 60 years ago. They were thinking of in the future. So us now, we need to think of the future as well, especially since climate change, it ain't going anywhere.
Gustavo Arellano, columnist to the LA Times, Greater LA Regular. Gustavo, as always, thanks.
Gracias. We took this trip.
trip to Garden Grove. Smell like Lou Dog inside the van. Oh yeah.
Of course we had to play this one coming out of it. That's going to do it for us tonight. Tomorrow, Housing for the Middle, a new state program that converts market-rate buildings in some of California's priciest markets into what's called moderate-income housing. That's tomorrow on the program. Wherever you are, by the way, in greater L.A., know that you're an important part of our mission. KCRW's Drive to the Future is our spring fundraiser, of course, but it not only benefits the radio station, it also benefits community organizations all around greater LA. So we're giving a portion of our proceeds and attention to homelessness. Today is the last day that part of your contribution will help provide legal aid for people experiencing homelessness. We also have this challenge. If we raise $20,000 today, a group of anonymous KCRW champions, some very beneficent people, will come in and they'll double it for us. So that's the challenge for tonight. We hope you will rise to the challenge. KCRW.com/give. And thank you for your support of KCRW. Once again, KCRW.com/give. I'm Steve Chiatakis, thanking you for your ears and time tonight. Have a great night.